Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
From high atop the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
The military ends Don't Ask, Don't Tell. A Clark County man kills and cremates his father. And an Australian airman is injured after a portable toilet explodes.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Tuesday, September 20th, 2011. The Clark County Sheriff's Office believes a 42-year-old Brush Prairie man killed his father, who had initially been reported as missing by the family. According to a probable cause statement, Troy A. Fisher, 43, reportedly was in a fight with his father, during which a gun discharged, hitting Edward F. Fisher, 69, in the head. The statement said Troy then fired a second shot into his father's back. The elder Fisher had not been seen since August 1st, and family members thought he was on vacation. Friends reported him missing after they hadn't heard from him in over a month. The probable cause statement said Troy Fisher told family members that his father, with whom he lived, had told him that an old girlfriend from Germany in the 1960s had offered to bring him to Europe on her yacht.
Sounds plausible.
The statement read, family members were suspect of this story.
Where was the yacht? Brush Prairie's not near the ocean.
No.
Where was the yacht going to dock?
I don't know.
Just going to pull up in the nearby pond and just whisk him away to a life of Teutonic ease?
In reality, it turns out, according to the statement, that Troy Fisher told police finally that he had taken his father's remains, put them on a burn pile, and cremated them.
With some newspapers and other disposables.
He had some stuff he needed to get rid of. He just cleared some brush at the back of the property. And
on a burn pile.
Yes.
That's how life ends.
He took bloodied pieces of living room carpet and dumped them alongside a road in northern Clark County.
Idiot. You have a burn pile. You have a pile of things you're burning.
Police also found two large holes cut out of the living room floor. So maybe his first plan was to, I don't know.
He's got a fire already going.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but the thing is, I think that he may have realized that a pile of brush is not sufficient heat to actually incinerate a body.
Well, no, but the carpet at least. Why would you just take the carpet and just dump it in the weeds somewhere?
Yeah, he should have burned the carpet.
He's already, I mean,
you're already burning stuff.
That's what I'm saying. It's not like he has to build a fire or get a kindling or make a little pyramid out of briquettes or something.
No.
He's already got a fire going.
Yeah.
The carpet's right here. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
He appeared in court Tuesday in a suicide smock, which is something I've never heard of before.
Is that from Donna Karan?
I'm assuming it is some kind of... is it something like a...
like a straitjacket?
Like a straitjacket, but now they're calling it... Because this just sounds cheerier.
All right.
He was denied bail and asked for a court-appointed attorney. Troy Fisher had worked at his father's forklift repair business.
Of course he had. I'm going to form a band called Suicide Smock. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. It is Tuesday, September 20th, 2011. Thank you for coming by on this glorious weekday. Coming up later on this hour, Science on the March and your entertainment news as well. Next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program at rickemersonshow.com. That is coming up next hour. If you want to get this program later on the day via iTunes, you can do that as well. You can also get it as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com and take it with you on your mobile device as well. That is mobile.cascadia.fm, wherever ye may roam.
The Pentagon formally repealed its ban on gays and lesbians in uniform on Tuesday at 12:01 a.m., allowing soldiers for the first time today, to reveal they're homosexual without fear of official retribution. The end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been in the works for months, but the formal repeal of the nearly 18-year-old law comes with what the Defense Department says is a zero-tolerance policy for anti-gay behavior that is on par with similar stances on religious, racial, and gender discrimination. Congress signed off on the repeal of the law in December, but gave military leaders time to retrain their soldiers to ensure that the change would not adversely impact the military.
That only took 20 years.
And I still would like to know what that training consisted of, other than don't be an asshat.
Maybe everybody has to have gay sex once.
Oh, so they can say, yeah, see, it's not so bad.
You know, until you have traveled a mile in a man's anus.
Yeah, isn't it? Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be anus-related to
I mean, for example.
Yeah. No one should be left with the impression that we are unprepared. Pentagon spokesman George Little said Monday, we are prepared for repeal. The force is well aware that this is coming. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman says repealing this policy is proof that Congress can work together.
In other news, Joe Lieberman still alive.
I think the most significant case, certainly in this session of Congress, that we can still come together across party lines.
Did the feeling a lot of times he goes to work and his key just doesn't open the door? And he's just standing, guys, let me in. Come on. And everybody's just, Congress is just rolling along without him and everybody's pretending they don't hear the knocking at the door.
Yes. Lieberman says this is, and I'm sure he sounds really cheerful about it as well. He says this is really positive for the country.
When a barrier breaks,
he's so upbeat.
Is broken for one group of Americans, the doors of opportunity open wider for every American.
Seriously, I'm telling you right now, if I were like Jeffrey Katzenberg or one of those guys and I was casting a droopy dog film, Joe Lieberman.
Yeah. Imagine him just like coming to your house for your birthday and giving you a gift and trying to like wish you happy tidings.
It's a really joyous occasion. Mitzvah to you.
Marine Sarah Pezat said today is a terrific coming out for her.
I'm grateful now to be able to serve my country with integrity and with my dignity intact. I can now look forward to getting mobilized to active duty. Instead of feeling like I have to shove my family back into the closet.
I'm sure it was a huge shock to everybody that Sarah Pezat is a lesbian as well. That sort of thing is never obvious to everybody around them.
But see, they didn't have to ask, so therefore, you know, she didn't need to be put in the position of not telling.
It must have just been a cavalcade of absurdities, though. You know, are you gay? No. You know,
I just like the idea of the first thing this morning. There are all these people in the military going, hey, I'm gay. And everyone else going, yeah, we knew. We actually had already sussed that out.
Or if it's just.
Yeah, but I could say so. Yeah, great.
Everybody feels like they're going to break it in by just asking a lot. Are you gay? No. You know, just everybody you see.
I would ask everyone today.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I might just, even though I'm not in the military. Rick, are you gay?
No. I mean, wait. No.
It's okay to be gay.
No.
Today.
Oh, yes. No.
Everyone's gay today.
No. Okay, yes. No.
I'm gay as a tangerine today.
Okay.
All right. A busload of Cycle Oregon volunteers was to leave Portland Tuesday money at 9 a.m. I'm sorry. Was to leave Portland Tuesday morning. That would be this morning at 9 a.m. To aid search efforts for missing volunteer Mark Bosworth. The volunteers were expected to help search Tuesday evening and again Wednesday. Bosworth, 53, was last seen walking along a road between Riddle, Oregon, and Canyonville early Saturday morning. He was reported missing Saturday afternoon, according to Dawes Houston with the Douglas County Sheriff's Office. Based on the latest information, which included that the man was wearing a headlamp, the family said investigators were focusing their Monday search efforts along Yoakum Road. There's a road, by the way, that runs between Riddle and Canyonville, Oregon, called Yoakum Road.
Also, doesn't headlamp sound strangely British?
Yes, it does.
Like when you call a harmonica a mouth organ?
Bosworth vanished after he left a booth on Main Street near Riddle High School around 11:30 p.m. on Friday during Cycle Oregon. Houston said Bosworth was probably not familiar with the Riddle area. He may have suffered a medical episode prior to his disappearance. He'd been battling cancer over the past several years and sometimes experienced problems associated with that. A posting on Cycle Oregon's Facebook page said Bosworth had complained of exhaustion and headaches and may have been acting erratically on Friday evening.
I like the idea that he became confused while walking near Riddle.
That is appropriate. Anyway, he's 6 feet tall, approximately 180 pounds, gray hair and blue eyes, last seen wearing a gray sweatshirt, black pants, and a hat. So if you see him, you know, he's worked for the past 20 years for Portland Metro. He's a GIS mapping specialist. Colleagues said he's an inspiration in the workplace, both for his professional accomplishments and for twice battling cancer.
Keep an eye out for that man, won't you?
Yes.
All right. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. And yes. Yes, indeed.
A bipartisan group of mayors meets with White House officials to discuss the administration's plans to create jobs. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa,
It is Villaraigosa.
Villaraigosa, I added the second time, praised the proposal and urged Congress to make it a reality.
The number one deficit in the country is the job deficit. And we want the Congress to work with the president.
If it's mellow, let it yellow. No. What is it? Who is it that said that? That was years ago.
Yeah,
Who was it?
San Francisco.
Ah, all right. Yeah. I just like any chance to say that because that was the... I remember just seeing that on... it must have been... That must have been in the late 70s or the early 80s or something. When was it? When was
that
the guy...
That was the 70s.
Yeah. I remember seeing that on television. It was on 60 Minutes or something. And it always stuck me and stuck with me. And so now whenever I think of mayors in California anywhere, I either think of the guy saying, if it's yellow, let it mellow, or I think of Jerry Brown just stooping Linda Ronstadt. That's it. Those are the only two things I ever think of when it comes to California mayors.
And that's really all you need to know.
Really? Yeah.
Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter hopes political bickering doesn't get in the way of making the legislation a reality.
The Congress needs to step up, do their job. They have jobs. We want to make sure that more Americans have jobs.
It must be sad to be Michael Nutter and know you're never going to be president.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed that he actually got, you know, elected mayor of Philadelphia with a name like that. Everybody driving around town seeing those signs saying, vote Nutter.
I mean, and I would, don't get me wrong. Well, yeah. I'd completely vote that. I'd vote the straight Nutter ticket is what I would do. But
I would like to have a president Nutter.
Yeah.
Although we'd have problems in Britain more than anywhere else.
Or just like, or just like President Benny. You know, like even as a first name. I could take, like we had a Jimmy, so we could, Have we had any other?
Teddy.
What do you call that? What do you call that when the name is sort of infantilized? Not like an abbreviation, but when it's given sort of a very casual, you know, sort of a colloquial abbreviation.
Remember.
Jimmy, yeah. Johnny, Jackie.
Yeah.
I think we've just
it's not
had
a nickname. Is it?
Well, it is, but it's a specific kind of nickname.
Yeah.
And it's also an abbreviation as such. Anyway, so we had Jimmy, we had Teddy. That may be it.
But see, the thing is, nobody else called him Teddy. We called him Teddy, but if he was at, like, official state thing, they called him Theodore Roosevelt.
Did they call him James Carter?
No, he was always,
President,
I believe,
Jimmy Carter.
To as Jimmy Carter.
That's pretty great. Yeah. I like that. You know, seems like a guy you could talk to. All right. President Benny.
President Obama, speaking of
who?
Presidents, that would be Benny Obama.
Okay.
He unveils a $3 trillion debt reduction plan. Arizona Republican Congressman Jeff Flake thinks the measure in its current form is dead on arrival because it calls for higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans.
The president himself said just a year or so ago, you don't raise taxes in the middle of a recession. And I think we're probably still there.
Oh, he's done. Flake says he's all for tax reform, but thinks raising tax rates during tough economic times is not the way to go.
If we want the economy to grow, we have to have competitive tax rates plus we've got to have some kind of moratorium on regulation.
I'm sure he'd be all for raising taxes during boom times, though. He couldn't raise taxes fast enough during the...
And also, raising taxes on the wealthiest people is really going to be a problem because they'll stop buying stuff. You know, they'll start, like that that asshat who was quoted all over the place yesterday, who said, after I feed my family and pay all my employees, I only bring home $400,000 a year. It's like, yes, he's gonna start clipping coupons and not purchasing things and contributing to the economy in any way.
I think the biggest problem with taxing the wealthiest Americans, and I mean like the absolute wealthiest Americans, is if you are one of the truly mind-bogglingly, staggeringly wealthy Americans, if you're one of the Buffett-sized Americans, it doesn't matter what the government does. You're not going to pay taxes anyway.
No.
You have people to make sure you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the group of people that we always want to tax are people that will never be able to successfully tax because they are more powerful than the government itself.
And plus, they are bitter and angry, so they will pay people enormous amounts of money to avoid giving the government enormous amounts of money.
As would I. Don't get me wrong. There was this thing a few years ago where Bill Gates, to his credit, he actually spent a lot of his own time, and I don't think he actually hired like a lawyer for it. But there was this thing, there was this famous 8, 9, 10 years ago, something like that, where Bill Gates spent, I don't know, like 6 months fighting a traffic ticket that he because he and he did that thing of like going to the traffic court and going, as you can see here in the roundabout, you have to go to the left. And then the traffic flow is such that when you get to the stop sign, there's this ficus that is blocking the yield, and it can't be seen. And he spent, like, months fighting this traffic court.
And his time is worth, like, $10,000 a minute.
And somebody calculated that if he'd been at Microsoft for that time, and he was probably getting paid anyway, but or he might have actually taken some time off from work. I don't know, but they calculated that he would have made, like, $9 million. But he was just like, well, I shouldn't have been given the ticket. I would absolutely do that kind of thing. I would just be a pest. More of a pest.
Well, a woman with a gun allegedly robbed a local tavern Monday night. Deputies say the armed robbery happened just before 9:30 p.m. at the Lighthouse 2 Tavern on Southeast 82nd in Clackamas. The suspect was last seen running away towards Beaver Lake Drive. She's described as a white woman, 30 to 35 years old, with a medium build and brown or gray hair.
Brown or gray.
Yes, either brown or gray. But she should be easy to spot because witnesses also say she has two black eyes and an injured nose.
And she just doesn't know when to stop talking. That's her other defining trait.
If you know anything about it, if you know a 30-year-old woman with a medium build and two black eyes and an injured nose who has a gun, call the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office's competent tip line at 503-723-4949.
She ran away. With a gun, you can get yourself a pretty good car.
That's what I heard. She was last seen running down the street with her gun and I guess her fist full of money.
Did she just steal it out of the register or something?
Well, she had a gun, so she probably said "gimme," and pointed the gun at someone.
Like to the clerk or the bartender or
yeah,
the...
probably the bartender.
All right, okay. Sure. All right. I have never been to the Lighthouse 2.
Well, the first Lighthouse was so brilliantly successful that they needed to create another one on Southeast 82nd.
Have you seen that bar on Southeast 82nd? It's the Tired Feet Tavern, but it's F-E-E-A-T.
No, I have not.
I've always wanted to stop in there and just ask the guy, like, what is up with that? Why it's the Tired Feet, F-E-A-T? Like, if it's a misspelling, but they didn't want to pay the paperwork a second time.
When I lived in California, I lived in Long Beach for about 6 months, and there was a bar we used to drive past that was called the Twilight Zone. And the outside of it was painted like with, you know, it was dark blue and it had stars all over it that. And it actually said the Twilight Zone, like the logo for the TV show. And one day we were driving past that, and my first husband, he just looked at me, he said, "You don't want to pass out in there."
No, you really don't. Because then you realize that you're really just a doll owned by Robert Duvall's daughter.
Yes, exactly.
There was like that, and that's stupid as well because, you know, it's just a matter of time before, like, CBS comes and tells you to knock it off, you know? Like that, there was that bar on the, wherever the hell, Holgate or some crap in Southeast, and it was the bar at the end of the universe. And it was all done in, like, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or the bar at the end of the galaxy or something like that. But it was, you know, and I think it was at some point, like, a guy showed up and, you know, who represented somebody, some publishing concern, and just told him to cut the crap, and they had to,
Well, like the guy with the Tommy's hot dogs here in Portland who was trying to pretend that he was affiliated with Tommy's in L.A., and Tommy's in L.A. said, "What, did you think we wouldn't hear about it?"
That's the thing.
It's not even like you're on a different coast.
In a best-case scenario, you become successful, which means that you will inevitably be found out. It makes no sense at all. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Legion of News. Here's Don Taylor.
Uniontown, Pennsylvania police are investigating the theft of an 8-foot, 800-pound stuffed and mounted bear. It was taken last Saturday night from the covered patio of the Eagle's Nest Bar on Morgantown Street. Owner John L. Ayazra said the five men were on the patio drinking when a cook came outside and saw the customers pushing the bear over a locked railing. The cook yelled at the man, who dropped the bear and ran away. Ayazra said, "Everybody knows the bear. Everybody go there, take picture with it."
Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Police were not able to push the bear back upstairs, so they left it outside under the stairwell. But police believe the same thieves later returned and dragged the bear away. Eliezer said the bear was given to him by a friend who shot it 10 years ago in Russia, and it has been on this patio ever since. If it was a joke, the bear would be here by now, he said. I think it's a serious crime. The bear is worth about $10,000. It's not a cheap bear.
In my country.
Yeah. Also, one of the thieves used his credit card when he was buying drinks.
Of course he did. Because why not? Where was this?
This was in Uniontown, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so it wasn't like a Morganville Road here or
wherever. No.
Oh, okay.
No.
So they just... So the bar... All right.
So they got drunk. They tried to steal the bear.
But then they just left the bear there.
Well, the police couldn't get it back over the railing. So I guess they figured it was huge and heavy. They said, okay, somebody will move it back over tomorrow morning.
But, I mean, the bar owners themselves just started to leave it there. That seems foolish.
That was a mistake on their part.
Yes, that was really, they miscalculated. There is what they did.
I almost, speaking of my first husband, I tried really hard to get him to let me spend $300 to buy a stuffed and mounted bear at a garage sale once. And he felt, first of all, that we should not spend $300 on a stuffed bear, but also that why would we want a stuffed bear? And all I could do was just kind of stand and go, stuffed bear!
Well, yeah.
Stuffed bear!
I mean, and it was only $300?
It was only $300.
I would absolutely be it.
Yeah, I should have put my foot down and really just said, oh, no, we are buying the bear.
No. I would have pitched on that. Have no doubt. I would have, yeah.
And that was my first husband. Patrick would be totally on board with buying a bear, a stuffed bear.
Well, that was the selling point for Patrick. That really is what put him over the top.
Well, yeah, that was one of the tests. Like, okay, let's say I call you in the middle of the day and say I just drove by a garage sale and I want to spend $300 on a stuffed bear. What do you say? You buy the bear.
I'll go get the car.
That's it. Cha-ching, you're in. Okay. Two Alaska Airlines attendants have been treated and released from an Anchorage hospital after feeling ill during a flight Sunday. The Anchorage Daily News said the two attendants working in the rear cabin felt nauseous and were short of breath on the evening flight from Portland, Oregon to Anchorage. And I believe if we're going to be technical about our grammar, it should be they felt nauseated.
Yes.
Not nauseous.
There's a listener who corrects me about that every single time. Every time I say nauseous, she emails me, and with only the best of intentions, I think, to tell me that that's wrong. And I've never really... That's one of my things that I can never... I guess I could take the time to look it up at some point. Like now, but I won't.
They reportedly felt better by the time the plane landed. Medics checked several other passengers in the rear of the plane, but no one else had the same symptoms. Alaskan Airlines spokesman Paul McElroy said the plane was inspected, air vents cleaned, and filters changed in the back of the plane. He said they don't know the cause, but are monitoring the plane, which is back in service. So that story wasn't nearly as interesting.
No, I thought it was going to go somewhere really, really thrilling, and then it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Okay.
You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. It is Tuesday, September 20th, 2011. Here is Don Taylor.
With science.
Really? Already?
Yeah.
It seems like science comes earlier every year.
Science kept getting later and later and later in the show, and it was cramming everything into the back end, so I'm trying to get back on schedule with it.
Excellent. Everyone listen. There we go. Here's your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. If you like, you can also go to Facebook, facebook.com/squiresElectric. Click the like button, if you would, while you are there. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. They make your life easier and more carefree, allowing you to kick back or possibly kick up your heels or possibly... A third thing that starts with kick that I can't really remember, but which, if I had it at my disposal right now mentally, would complete that comedic trifecta. You call them at 503-252-1609. If you're going to be moving into a different home, buying a home, selling someone your existing structure, or moving your business into a different location, they can make sure that everything works properly. They also handle upgrade. They also handle repair and making sure you pass your next inspection. These are all things they can do. You contact them at SquiresElectric.com. They're the proud sponsors of this, your Science on the March.
The Milky Way, some 1.75 billion years ago, was apparently hit by a smaller galaxy that swung by our neck of the cosmic woods and smeared out our stars in a gravitational tug of war. Astronomers have simulated this galactic close encounter in the best detail yet so far and suggest that it may have formed the Milky Way's dramatic spiral arms. Small galaxy interactions could thus play a bigger role in shaping galaxies than previously thought, according to Chris Purcell of the University of Pittsburgh and the University of California, Irvine, and his colleagues in the September 15th Nature.
Smeared.
Yeah, apparently another galaxy came this way, and that's why it's all ours is looks all swirly.
Okay.
Well, you know, I didn't say it was fun. I just said it was science.
It's interesting.
Yeah. I don't care about any of this stuff, so it's going away. Julia Jonas Urbonus, a PhD candidate in London.
Jonas Urbonus?
No, Julia Jonas Urbonus.
Okay, all right.
A PhD candidate in London's Royal College of Arts Design Interactions Department has created a unique way to voluntarily end your life. He has designed the euthanasia coaster. The three-minute ride involves a long, slow climb, nearly a third of a mile long, that lifts one up to a height of more than 1,600 feet, followed by a massive fall and seven strategically sized and placed loops. The final descent and series of loops take all of 1 minute, but the gravitational force, 10 Gs, from the spinning loops at 223 miles per hour, is lethal. According to Urbonus, the euthanasia coaster is a hypothetic euthanasia machine in the form of a roller coaster, engineered to humanely, with elegance and euphoria, take the life of a human being.
I figured that it would be easier just to have the thing go, and then, like, the first drop just goes right into a wall.
Well, that...
But climbs and climbs and climbs, bam, into a wall.
Yeah, but you'd have to keep replacing that first car.
Well, yeah, and then you have to, a lot of power washing.
Yeah. Well, the thought of merging the fun and perhaps fear of a roller coaster with suicide doesn't occur to most people. It seemed obvious to designer Urbonus. He said, briefly put, the inspiration was my PhD study and my long-term affair with amusement parks. Urbonus, who once worked at an amusement park in his native Lithuania, considers this research in gravitational aesthetics. That's because the euthanasia coaster isn't simply meant to be about death. Urbonus sees it as both an intellectual and artful departure from the world, one that isn't about the paperwork and medical issues of the current euthanasia system. The few places where voluntary euthanasia is legal include Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and the U.S. states of Oregon and Washington. He said there's no special ritual, nor is death given special meaning, except that of the legal procedures and psychological preparation. Is it like death is divorced from our cultural life? But if it's already illegal, why not make it more meaningful? He is built into the long, slow trek up to the top before the first fall. In the three-minute ride, 2 minutes are devoted just to the climb upwards. He writes, the rider has a few minutes to contemplate his decision and his life in retrospect. He would find enough time to adapt to the height and get through the series of imaginary fatal falls while realizing that the objects on the ground are getting smaller. The slightest movement of the car would trigger intense heart beating and goosebumps, and most importantly, it would test your decision. Therefore, the very top of the tower is an ideal place to give it the very last word.
Doesn't it seem like, I mean, as...
Oh, by the way, then at the very top, you're required to make the decision, and if you want to continue living, you can, like, stop the coaster, but if you're really ready to end it, there's a fall button.
Okay, see, so that was going to be my question, because as much dread as... Sorry.
Like that.
That was a little bit of a thing. As much dread as the roller coasters are normally filled with, like... What if you got to the top and he went, oh, wait a minute, I do have something to live for. Ah, crap. And then it's just, as you're climbing up to the top the whole time going, well, crap, well, this is not where, I didn't mean to come on this ride. I wasn't thinking it all the way through.
See, and then you go, you just don't hit that button. Okay. And then I guess there's probably a platform you can get out and then just ride an elevator down and go, whew, that was close.
It's like the, it's like that suicide booth that they have on Futurama,
yeah.
You know, where you can just, you know, option one, fast and easy, option two, slow and horrible. You know, but then you have a...
Yeah. And in this one, if you decide you do want to go down on the roller coaster, then basically it's cerebral hypoxia, where you're spinning fast enough, your brain doesn't get enough oxygen to keep functioning. The blood rushes into the body instead of up out into the brain. And then, you know, he said that you'd probably be awake after the initial fall. Your vision would blur. You'd lose your peripheral sight and probably even then black out. And then... But he said, but there would also be euphoria, because apparently you have, like, this huge adrenaline rush.
We call that going out Everest style.
But, yeah, so I just want to go on the record and say I would totally do that. I love roller coasters, and, you know, at some point I know I'm just going to be done.
Yeah. No, I'm bullish on it. Yes.
Yeah. With the cancellation of the space shuttle, a lot of NASA workers were shown pink slips, but one entrepreneur decided to make the use of all that engineering talent and build up a local auto industry at the same time. Ray Ackley had a lot of experience with frames for racing cars, having worked for a long time designing and selling kits used to make them. He ran into a group of about 15 NASA engineers that were looking for work to do on the side, since they knew they might well lose their jobs once the shuttle program was canceled. The Emerging Growth Institute, their new nonprofit that works with emerging technology companies, got together with Ackley and the engineers and said they should design a frame for the vehicle, a three-wheeled frame. They call it the Tricycle and formed a company, Tricycle Gold, to mass produce it. Besides having three wheels, there are some new wrinkles to the design. The frame is molybdenum alloy, offering a lot more strength and rigidity than one would have in a typical motorcycle. The engine is off-the-shelf Chrysler. Welding is done by putting the frame into a kind of truss that allows for putting together the joints all at once instead of piecemeal. The idea was to attack a market that had not been served well, said Michael Schulman, Ackley's assistant. While there are three-wheeled motorcycles out there, they tend to be expensive in the $40,000 range, and the kits to make a two-wheeled bike into a three-wheeler aren't much cheaper. The centers of gravity tend to be high, so such motorbikes can't take corners fast. The Tricycle is much lower to the ground with a much longer wheelbase, so it's difficult, if not impossible, to flip over onto its side, and it can't do wheelies. Since the engineers designing it were NASA veterans, they approached it in a fashion similar to rocket design, drawing on their experiences with aerospace engineering to design a streamlined frame that was light and strong. Tricycle has a waiting list for buyers, and the company has been offered a $5 million line of credit, although it is open to other offers as well.
But anytime they say that something can't be tipped over, something can't be set on fire, something can't be shattered into a million pieces, something can't kill you, that just reads as a challenge, I think, to vast sections of humanity.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because then that ensures more news for us. But it's like that that BMW that they sell is sort of being death-proof, which seems like it's just... I mean, all that makes you want to do is just speed, just recklessly, with abandon, and just take corners, at 190 miles an hour and go through red lights with your eyes closed.
Woohoo! Can't kill me!
Or me, at least. That's, yeah. All right.
That's all the science for today.
There you go. Wow, starting early, ending early. Yeah. We're really Johnny on the spot here. That is your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com, or you can call 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. 09 Squires Electric, proud sponsors of this, your Science on the March. That is Squires Electric at squireselectric.com. Don't forget, coming up later on, your entertainment news and the Rick Emerson radio program next hour at rickemersonshow.com. Here is Don Taylor.
A Vancouver, Washington man power washing a silo at an industrial site got electrocuted on Monday. Sergeant Stephen Shea with the Clark County Sheriff's Office said the victim or some object touched a nearby power line. The victim was electrocuted inside the high lift. The 42-year-old man, whose name has not yet been released, was found collapsed at 418 Northwest Hayes Road in Woodland sometime later. No one witnessed the accident, so it's unknown exactly what happened. The victim's boss administered CPR until rescue units arrived, but the man could not be saved. Investigators said he was announced dead at the scene. The victim worked for Furrer Construction Incorporated. Federal hearings on SeaWorld started on Monday, addressing a trainer who was killed by a killer whale last year. OSHA says SeaWorld didn't take proper precautions to protect Don Brancho. David Kirby wrote a book on the incident. He thinks it's the company's responsibility to protect people from the dangers at the park.
SeaWorld was obviously aware that this was a whale who had killed or been involved in the deaths of two other people. And to allow Dawn to get in the water so close to the whale, SeaWorld let her do it. You can't blame a killer whale for killing somebody.
Never let Dawn too close to the killer whales,
no.
I say.
And I wonder if they, is that a thing that SeaWorld, like, they knew about it? I wonder if they told people that, or if they lied about it, or if they just sort of omitted it, if it was a lie of exclusion. Is there anything else I needed to know about the whale before I get in? No, you've got all the pertinent data there. That's,
Of course, you know, the thing is that they're not called killer whales because they're vicious and they kill more than other whales. They're called killer whales. I think it's purely because you can see their little teeth or something.
Actually,
but it's not. But
as I understand it, and this is solely based on what Thomas Gill has told me, they are called killer whales because that is actually an incorrect reversal of what they were originally called, which was whale killers, because they are not whales, they're dolphins.
Yes, there we go.
But let's be clear about this. They hella killed her. They killed
her dead.
I mean, they killed her as no one has ever been whale killed before.
A former SeaWorld trainer, Carol Ray, says the same whale had killed two other people before.
She was a star trainer at SeaWorld. If it had been brought to her attention that she shouldn't be doing that, I'm sure that she wouldn't be doing that.
Meanwhile, your tea is done in the background.
Yeah.
Just FYI.
It's like, oh, did we not... Tell you what, the new trainer, don't tell her about the whale.
See, but
he's probably done killing.
I reject the assertion that she wouldn't have gone in if she'd known that the whale... I mean, it's a thing that has, like, rows of teeth and he's huge and is also, what do you call it, a wild animal.
But she was obviously trained to work with the animals, though. She might have dealt with it differently had she known its history.
I deal with them by staying far, far away in a Winnebago in Kansas.
Okay.
That's just me. That's my only, you know.
An Australian airman injured in a portable toilet explosion in July has died. Sergeant Michael McDunn was participating in a joint exercise with the U.S. military at the time. A 27-year veteran of the Royal Australian Air Force, Dunn died in an Australian hospital Tuesday morning. Dunn suffered third-degree burns to his head, face, arms, chest, and airways after a portable toilet he was in exploded during Talisman Sabre, a biannual joint military and humanitarian exercise. Officials said they believed a fuel spill was to blame, but would not comment on the source of ignition. The investigation into the explosion continues. The incident occurred at Rockhampton Airport, about 300 miles north of Queensland's capital of Brisbane. Talisman Sabre wrapped up the end of July. There were several high-profile incidents during this year's Talisman Sabre exercise. In addition to Dunn's death, 9 Australian service members were injured when an armored vehicle rolled down an embankment in the Shoalwater Bay training area north of Rockhampton. They were all expected to recover. And a U.S. Navy sailor, Petty Officer Third Class James Eric Linnebury, faces possible court-martial and jail time pending a Navy investigation into the death of an Australian bicyclist during the same event. But how does a portable toilet explode?
Well, I mean, if it was just like a standalone toilet like we have here in the States, where it's just a plastic tub filled with poo, then I don't really know the answer. I mean, unless
there's maybe a fuel spill. So if some fuel had like spilled and pooled underneath of it, and then he decided he was going to like light up a cigarette while he was in there,
or if it was some sort of like toilet of tomorrow, today, where it was. Where there was some sort of a mechanical apparatus that disposed of the waste, or I don't know, like atomized it or something, or whatever. Or if there was like a fan unit maybe that is responsible for ventilation,
and something sparked,
and then it sparked, or there was, I mean, you're tempted to say that it was some sort of, like, you know, accumulation of methane gas or whatever, but it seems like they put chemicals in there to keep that from happening. I don't really know. It seems like any time you go into a portable toilet, you have to brace yourself with the fact that something bad, something in fact, the worst thing that's ever happened to you may happen.
They are terrible, terrible places.
And it could be any number of things. That's the thing. It's like, it's not just one outcome. There are probably 5 different things that could happen to you in a portable toilet that could, I mean, without somebody coming in and assaulting you, that would still be the worst thing that had ever happened to you.
The worst thing, from my perspective, is generally trying really hard not to drag, like, the tail of my shirt or my sweater or something through that urinal that's just stuck on the side of the thing, you know?
Is that a problem?
Well, they're very small, and you're moving around, and if you actually sit down, because that's the Lee and the Lady, you sit down to do your business, and then you're, like, trying not to touch anything, but the thing is, if you were, like I often do, a loose shirt over another shirt, and then it's right there. It's like 3 inches away from you is this plastic, you know, ovoid
thing.
It's
like a miniature sink.
Yeah, and it's this little ovoid plastic thing, and it's still full of other people's pee, you know, and it's because it doesn't all drain all the way down. And so then you try not to, like, drag the... You think you've done really, really well, and you're not, you know, doing anything that's going to kill you later, and then realize that you've dragged the corner of your shirt through somebody's pee. They're horrible places. Plus, you almost can't hold your breath long enough while you're in there.
Oh, but I can. That's the thing.
But you can try. You sure can try.
No, I really have perfected. I think that is the only reason that I'm able to hold my breath for any appreciable length of time is because I think I learned early on that was a place you can't breathe. And then there's many public bathrooms or rest stops. They're like rest stops on the highway, like if I'm on 395 or something. And it's like you stop and you just sort of brace yourself. You kind of go like, oh, all right, Emerson, let's just get through this. And then we'll get back in the car where it's nice and clean. And you just, you know, boom, kick the door open. And then I also have mastered the ability to do everything with my foot. Open the door, boom, you know, flush the toilet, turn on the faucet. You kick the door back open again to get to the car. I don't breathe. I don't touch. I try not to let anything, you know, brush anything else. No, it's bad. Somebody says the porta potty is like a poo-based Iron Maiden. It really is true. It's like a horrible medieval device of just pain and suffering.
Yes.
And apparently the soaking of your clothing in other people's urine, which is a thing that I haven't experienced, but I can see how that might be. I can see how that might be trouble, especially if you're a lady and you're having to turn and position and jostle and orientate yourself correctly, and it's just horrifying. In fact, I do have to say that, I mean, this is just maybe me thing. But I mean, I am 38 years of age, and I think I have gone. I mean, I think I've gone most of my life. I'll put it this way. I don't think I've ever had to do the whole sit-down business in there. I mean, I'd rather go home. I'd rather get in the car and drive 4 hours and go home and do it
also,
there.
Also, never look down in there.
Oh, I've done that, though.
And you can't help it. There's this part of you that's just like, you're just curious. And,
no, it's a
and
car
then
wreck.
You immediately regret it.
No, it's just, no, that really is just that's just a fecal highway accident is what that is.
Yeah.
And you don't want to look, and then you do.
Yeah.
Especially if you dropped your keys.
Yeah. Portland has wrapped the busiest filming season ever in the city, according to Mayor Sam Adams. Adams said it's becoming more common to see a production team shooting a movie, TV show, or commercial in Portland these days, and the increased attention from Hollywood is great news for the local economy. In the mayor cites several examples, including the TNT show Leverage, which employs 450 local workers during shooting. In addition, 90% of the crew for the IFC Portlandia consists of workers from the Portland area. According to city officials, local film industry crews have kept busy on other large projects, including a Hollywood feature film, several independent films, three car commercials, a commercial and commercial and photography work for local businesses as well, such as Nike and Adidas.
Woo-hoo.
So there we go. Oh, I wanted to read this because this is just delightful. Everyone's talking about 81-year-old astronaut Buzz Aldrin, who was recently spotted with former Borders exec Michelle Soussian, 51. The two met at one of Aldrin's book signings 2 years ago and began dating. The two reportedly, quote, making out like teenagers on an Amtrak train on Saturday.
Good for him.
According to Page Six. By the way, when he was on the moon, she was 9.
Yeah. Well, you know.
That's kind of cool. Aldrin was married for 23 years to Lois Driggs Cannon, his third wife, and their divorce is pending. Cannon told the a local newspaper she is not happy about his dating. He's not officially divorced yet. It is kind of scandalous. We've had a great life, and I don't blame Buzz. I blame the girl. She's a predator. And honest to God, if you see her, I think 51 is a lie. She is scary looking.
I mean, he was an astronaut, though. It seems like that's pretty much a ticket just to, that really is an e-ticket for the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, I'm saying if you go take a look.
What is her name?
Michelle Soussian, S-U-C-I-L-L-O-N. Says she's 51. She is in her mid-60s if she's a day.
S-U-C-I-L-L-O-N. All right, let's see here.
He filed for divorce in June. The book signing where they met was in 2009, and I was there, his wife says. She was kind of aggressive, but he didn't start seeing her then. He's been seeing her for about a year. She went on to say she felt Aldrin was having a midlife crisis in old age, and she hopes they can get back together again.
A midlife crisis? Yes, he's going to live to be 170. I'm looking. Okay, so here's a little bit of a Sarah Palin thing going on. I mean, she's. If this is the right woman, is this woman in this very low cut tank top? First of all, he's got a great look on his face. His look is like, yeah, that's me, Buzz Aldrin. I'm in that. And then she, she is a little bit of a.
Oh, okay. I was looking at the picture of him with his wife. So yeah. So yes. Yeah, so the.
Oh no. Well, you don't want to.
So I buy this woman is 51.
I mean, clearly, as I think Buzz Aldrin himself has demonstrated, you don't want to be. Hitting.
No, I saw that picture and I said she's not 51.
Yeah, you know. Well, why?
Yeah,
do
no, she's like 70.
Why do you think he's moved on? Yeah. Why do you think he's not? Why do you think he's not partial to that anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this other woman is not so much even Sarah Palin. She looks like Tina Fey as Sarah Palin.
Yeah,
and I approve.
No, she is very attractive.
Yeah, she is.
And Buzz,
but the look
Buzz
on his
looks
face,
a little smug.
He's got that. He's just got there. Yep, me, Buzz Aldrin, hitting that. That's just it's. I mean, what's great about him is he's like 1,000 years old. So he's with this woman, and then he also just like. I don't know, however long ago that was, where he just decked that guy at a public event. Where they go, what about aliens on Mars? Poof! And Aldrin just pasted him right in the kisser.
Yep.
All right. Well,
yeah.
They are our best and brightest, Dawn. They have the right stuff.
Trying to figure out what to do. So many things to choose from. So much news. Georgia officials will proceed with the high-profile execution of Troy Davis on Wednesday after the state's pardons board rejected his last-ditch plea for clemency. Davis was convicted of killing an off-duty police officer who was rushing to the defense of a homeless man being attacked in 1989. But Davis and his lawyers maintain it was a case of mistaken identity and say there is new evidence that indicates another man at the scene was the one who fired the fatal shot. Among the high-profile supporters who backed Davis's clemency bid were former President Jimmy Carter, Pope Benedict XVI, and a number of former federal officials, according to the Associated Press. Davis's case, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution says, has already taken more unexpected turns than just about any death penalty case in Georgia history, and his innocence claims have attracted international attention. State officials have set an execution date for Davis four times in as many years, but on the three prior times he was granted stays, twice only hours before he was set to be put to death. Tomorrow seems likely to be pushed back as well, when state officials announced late yesterday that they would not be making an immediate decision on Davis's fate. But after hearing hours of testimony from his supporters and prosecutors, the board denied the request for clemency. The board has the sole authority in Georgia to grant or deny clemency. Amnesty International has called the decision unconscionable. Larry Cox, the USA director, said, should Torrey Davis be executed, Georgia may well have executed an innocent man, and in so doing discredited the justice system.
Yeah, the best part is how most of the witnesses have now flat out just reversed their testimony and said, well, that I was just making that up. I'm sorry. But that apparently... And apparently is not enough to that in and of itself, the fact that you may have been railroaded by a series of witnesses who were at the very least mistaken and at most flat out committing perjury, that is not enough to raise doubts in anybody's mind.
No,
because why would it?
And plus, it's Georgia. I mean, like, they haven't had a chance to, like, kill anybody in a while. They're
well, that's
true. Looking forward to
They're going through Twitch withdrawal.
Yeah. Let's do our entertainment news.
Here's your entertainment news for Tuesday, September 20th, 2011. Right here at Cascadia.fm.
Ashton Kutcher's debut on the CBS sitcom Two and a Half Men on Monday was seen by 27.7 million people. The Nielsen Company says that's more than any other episode in the first eight seasons when Sheen was the star.
Did you watch any of it?
No.
They found a great number of excuses to have him in the altogether, to have him either, I mean, not like you weren't seeing his tackle or whatever, but to have him either partially or completely undressed.
Who, Ashton Kutcher?
Ashton Kutcher.
Oh.
I think to underscore the fact that Charlie Sheen is like 70. and I mean, it.
Look how handsome he is.
It's not like I was, you know, like a huge fan of Two and a Half Men or something beforehand, but I.
No, it's an awful show.
But yeah, but Charlie Sheen, you know, he had the whole thing of playing this Lothario, and I. Which, you know, after like 10 years, it was wearing a trifle thin. And so I think they were trying to underscore the difference by casting Ashton Kutcher, who's, you know, who is younger and a little more, it doesn't seem like his body is about to fall apart at any moment.
And maybe it'll breathe a little bit of life into it. I mean, it actually was kind of funny the first couple of seasons, but it wore out its welcome
right.
Years ago. And the last couple of times I tried to watch it, it was just nothing but really bad, unfunny sex jokes.
The weird thing is like how the, just the whole opening, because it opened... like with the funeral, and it just seemed to go on and on, like forever and ever. If there had been no laugh track, if there had been no audience there, it would have been really disturbing, frankly. It just seemed to just be endless. I mean, it was almost, you could just sense, what is it, Chuck Lorre?
Yeah,
that the
Chuck
guy?
Lorre.
You could just sense him sort of cackling and just rubbing his hands together behind the Avid as he's editing it together and just sort of suck this, Sheen. And just, I mean, it went on and on ad nauseum with it.
Los Angeles police say they have arrested actor Tom Sizemore on an outstanding warrant for misdemeanor battery. Officer Rosario Herrera said the 49-year-old was arrested early Tuesday. The LA County Sheriff's Department says Sizemore has posted $26,000 bail and been released. Sizemore, who appeared in Black Hawk Down and Saving Private Ryan, has had a string of drug-related arrests in recent years. And, of course, he was convicted in 2003 of domestic violence involving his ex-girlfriend, Heidi Fleiss. The writer and director... I seem to have lost something here.
Would you like to just take...
No, I'm just going to put a big X through this and not read it because the first sentence seems to be missing, so it wouldn't make any sense.
All right.
Ari Fleischer, former press secretary for George W. Bush, has joined CNN as a political contributor. Having worked on a successful presidential campaign and having spent 21 years in Washington, I'm looking forward to joining CNN as a regular contributor, he said. It's shaping up as a red-hot political year, and I'm eager to lend my perspective to it.
It's Ari Fleischer's red-hot political fall.
Fleischer was Bush's press secretary during and after the 9/11 attacks. He wrote a best-selling memoir in 2005 titled Taking Heat. Lea Michele of Glee has broken up with her boyfriend, Theo Stockman, who is in American Idiot on Broadway. E! News, E! With an exclamation point. Initially broke the news on Monday that Michelle, 25, and Stockman, 26, who was by her side at the infamous Time 100 Gala Namegate incident, I don't know what that is, have called it quits. Our rep said in a statement, "This is not a dramatic breakup. The relationship just ran its course. They are still friends and will always be friends."
What do you suppose Namegate is?
I have no idea.
All right, so this is Leah Michelle?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing. So I'm going to look it up. And then
it had something to do with the Time 100.
Okay, so I'm gonna look it up, and we'll see if you can. And what you should do is this: you should create without any. Have you just X'd out that story over there?
Yes.
Is that like when you put "Do not amputate" on a limb? Like
yes.
You've just run a huge thing through it, so you don't try to read it again. All right. So without any knowledge, without looking up anything else about it, you should now just create on the fly what you think Namegate might be. Like if I just said, okay, it involves Leah Michelle and I guess maybe her boyfriend who was present, and it's called Namegate. What was it?
I'm imagining, since it said he was by her side, I'm thinking it is either she was listed as one of the top 100 something or other for Time magazine, and they misidentified her in the photo, or the two of them were in a photo for that, and it has something to do, I'll bet you it has something to do with her being misidentified in a photo. Like they said, Leah Michelle is one of the hot somebody or others, and it wasn't her in the photo. Or somebody else was listed as being somebody hot, and it was her in the picture.
All right, so apparently what happened is this is at the at a party for the Time 100, which is a list of the world's most influential people.
Uh-huh.
Which seems to maybe not have the strictest of standards
Not if she's on the list.
I mean, really, that's... It seems like you don't have to be very high to ride that ride.
She's on Glee.
Glee's Leah Michelle has issued an apology on Twitter to a photographer who reportedly asked her for her name after he photographed her at the party for Time 100, a list of the world's most influential people. So the photographer's there at this list of the, the party for the list of the 100 most influential people. He asks her her name. She rolls her eyes and said, "I'm Taylor Swift." Apparently. He then followed up by asking her name again, at which point she identified herself as being Sarah Palin and rolled her eyes a second time. Either rightly or wrongly irritated or shocked that he would not know who she was, since she is one of the 100 most powerful people on planet Earth.
She was at the party. Was she actually on the list? All we know is that she was at the party.
It says Taylor Swift and Sarah Palin were women who had also made the magazine's cut, implying she did. So reflexively, it seems as though...
Well, I guess...
That seems improbable that she is, out of 6 billion people, one of the 100 most influential people in the world. I mean, I don't want to bring too much science to it.
On the other hand, though, I can only fault her so much if she's one of the people on this list, which is why she's at the party, and... The photographer's asking her name.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see kind of going, seriously? I'm one of the people.
Although you got to figure if you're a photographer, you just get a call that morning going like, "Ted, you got to go be at this place and like film these chicks from, some show." And you go, "All right." And that's probably like a 17th photo shoot you've done that day.
Yeah.
So I think the problem, of course, was that it was captured on film and that everybody saw her do it.
Well, the problem was that Time decided to put her on a list of 100 most influential people to begin with because... No. Dolores Hope, widow of the iconic comedian Bob Hope, died Monday morning in her home in Toluca Lake, California. Hope, who was born Dolores Defina, was 102 and was married to Bob Hope from 1934 until his death in 2003. The couple had four children, and Dolores gave up her singing career to stay home and raise them. She will be buried beside her husband in the San Fernando Mission Cemetery on Friday in a private service.
I don't know. Where is Toluca Lake? It's just a place I hear referenced in vaudeville routines. I have no idea where it actually is.
I think it's the valley.
It's like the Okefenokee Swamp. Yeah. I got no idea where that is.
I think it's the San Fernando Valley.
Sure. Okay. All right.
Although, I mean, apparently being married to Bob Hope involved a lot of, like, just, staying married to Bob Hope. I guess she just clung like a barnacle no matter what. Because I guess he was a horrible, horrible person, particularly in his latter years.
Well, he was a well-known philanderer as well. Yeah. I mean, it was fairly. I mean, that was in an era I think when that sort of thing was easier to keep under wraps too. And there have been numerous well-researched accounts and biographies that have come out that he had multiple women set up in multiple apartments around California and around the country.
Well, I remember reading an article about him in a magazine that the magazine writer was invited to stay at his home in Vegas. Palm Springs. And it was this huge compound, and Bob Hope basically lived on one side of it, and his wife lived way over on the other side of it. And he was staying in this guest room, and there's this knock on the door at like about 11:30 at night after he'd gone to bed, and it's Bob Hope going, "Come on, let's go into town.
Let's go get some whores."
You know, he's like 80 or something. Yeah, the guy's going, "I was going to go to sleep." "No, come on. I'll show you stuff. I'll introduce you to some people. We'll meet some ladies."
Well, I mean, that's how my grandparents lived, except it was not so much it was not really in a palatial mansion. It was just like in this sort of double wide in Silverton. But I mean, it was the same principle. It was like try to be in opposite corners of the house and keep different schedules so you only cross paths accidentally, you know?
So Sting turns 60 next month. He's also celebrating 25 years as a solo performer by releasing a box set of his work during those years. Sting describes what he's most proud of over that span of time.
What do you think it is? I don't know what the answer to this is, but what do you think Sting is most proud of?
It's probably not going to be the fact that he can hold off orgasm for 6 hours.
How weird that that's the thing he's going to be known for. Yeah. Like, but see, wouldn't it be like, if you were Sting, wouldn't you be more proud of that than anything?
Let me talk again about the tantric sex.
It's weird how that can just, like, you just give one interview one time to one magazine, because that was in Rolling Stone, I think. And that now just like, it's like what's her name? It's like Punky Brewster and her boobs. That's just, doesn't matter what she does. She could, she could cure shingles. And that's going to be the thing that everybody knows her for. Yeah, but what about her? Let's talk about the Felicity chick cutting her hair again.
I bet he says he's most proud of his humanitarian work.
All right. It's like, you know what? I was thinking about this last night. You know who else is tagged with this? So there's Sting and the tantric sex. There's Punky Brewster and her breasts. There's Chamberlain
having sex with like 40,000 women.
Yeah, there's that. And then, I was also thinking about Brandi Chastain. Do you remember her?
No.
Okay, you do. You just don't know that you do. Brandi Chastain is the woman that everybody knows because she was like, I don't know, she was in the Olympics or some crap for the women's soccer team, and then she made the winning.
She took off the shirts.
There you go.
Yeah.
I didn't even have to finish the sentence, and you knew
That's
exactly
right.
what I was talking about.
Yeah.
That's her thing forever.
Yeah.
She's also
Milton Berle and his penis.
Yeah. Well.
To a lesser degree, Forrest Tucker.
I mean, again, you know, I guess it all depends on where your priorities are. That might be the sort of thing like Milton Berle might have been like, you know, by the time I wrap up, everybody is going to know, you know, about my penis and its massive girth, which if that's the case, then job well done. But all right, let's see what Sting is actually the most proud of.
My proudest moment is, I suppose, having six wonderful, healthy.
Oh, sorry. That's my sorry.
Proudest moment is, I suppose, having six wonderful, healthy, happy children.
Boo.
I can't imagine anything more important
than
that.
It's a terrible... He can't even imagine.
Anybody can breed, Sting.
Seriously.
You're Sting.
It's not even that he doesn't... The worst part is when he says he, quote, can't even imagine anything better than that. You're not trying hard enough.
Yeah, you're Sting.
Imagine harder.
People in trailer parks have six children. It's not that hard to have six children.
Fame is wasted on the wrong people.
Sting says he feels fortunate that he's been successful.
Band and then embarked on this thing was a big risk. You know, there was no guarantee it would work. But 25 years later, I can look back and say, well, that was a pretty good decision you made there.
The thing about Sting is, like, I want to dislike him and I just can't.
Because
he does seem like such a decent, like, down-to-earth normal guy. But I don't know. It is the thing of, with anybody else, you know what he is? He's a more polished and believable version of Bono. Because Bono would say exactly the same crap, and you go, you are so full of... But when Sting says it, like, it somehow is a little more believable.
Sting, again, who turns 60 next month, says he hopes his best work is yet to come.
As you get older and wiser, you're supposed to get better. Even though it's pop music, I think you can get better. That's my hope. That's my dream. I'd like to create something that people go, wow.
Well, let's not tell him that's unlikely to happen. All right. Now we have 15 seconds here.
Sting!
Really?
Every breath you take, every move
Oh, great.
You
now,
make.
See, now Wagner has to pay for that. Well done.
Oh, fuck.
Well, All right, there you go. And, well, just, there we go. We'll be done with that there. All right. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Legion of News. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, Iowa, over the Milkpacking District here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agle, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. We thank you for joining us today. We'll be back again tomorrow, that is Wednesday at noon, for another episode of Legion of News. You can get this in the meantime at Cascadia.fm as a direct MP3 download, or at LegionofNews.com, or via iTunes, or on your mobile device at mobile.cascadia.fm. Are you hearing like a... like a pinking.
A bong sound,
a
yes.
A bonging, plinking.
I am hearing a pinking.
Pinking sort of a sound.
Yes, I am.
All right. I figured.
I think it's coming from your side.
I don't know what it could be, though. Well, I'll look into that. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. That is Wednesday at noon for another exciting episode of Legion of News, and next hour at RickEmersonShow.com. Thank you for listening. Have a good day.